I'm going to just introduce our speaker, Lily, now. She is an activist at UCID up in Sydney. She's been involved in a whole number of campaigns around the environment, so throwing herself in, backing up the school strike for climate that happens in March, as well as being a socialist activist at in Sydney. So she's going to be speaking on the topic for about 35 minutes. People should hold their questions, comments, thoughts for the discussion, where we'll have plenty of time. So I'll just let her take it away now.
Well, earlier this year, people may have seen these scenes. This is Cyclone Idai that ripped through Mozambique, Malawi and Zimbabwe, some of the poorest countries in the world, and caused utter devastation. So the city of Beira in Mozambique was hit the hardest. Nearly 80% of homes and public infrastructure was destroyed. It's hard to imagine. And from that as well, the flooding and landslides have ruined crops across the region, leaving 1.6 million people economically devastated too, and hundreds are now estimated dead. No single extreme weather event can be attributed 100% to climate change, but I think looking at these disasters across the world and their increasing frequency means that we have to draw something from this. These are by no means isolated incidents. The hotter the ocean gets, the more powerful the cyclones will be. The hotter the oceans are, the melting of the ice caps as well means oceans levels rise. And this means in turn as well that cyclones spin faster, they do more damage, and they have more energy as well. So Idai, I think we have to see as just one terrifying symptom of a world that continues to burn fossil fuels for energy. And you can see all kinds of different disasters also wreaking havoc across the world. Prolonged drought is exacerbating wildfires from Tasmania to Greece to the California hills. The sixth mass extinction in the planet's history has now begun. Hurricanes are getting more and more intense. Ocean acidification as well is becoming more extreme because more carbon dioxide is being absorbed. And the world's coral reefs as well have begun to die. It's like the climate crisis is now. And this is just with one degree of warming. With an additional degree of warming, all of these symptoms will get far, far worse. And this is why the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has recently said that warming should be kept to 1.5 degrees. Some say that this is an impossible target due to past emissions. So regardless of what we do now, the world actually now is locked into warming of between 1.5 and 2 degrees around 2050. It reminds me of Karl Marx writing, "The tradition of dead generations weighing like a nightmare on the minds of the living." I think in this warming world we live in today, this nightmare of past emissions weighs down heavier and heavier day by day on the bodies of the living and all of our surroundings. But let's indulge for a second this idea of keeping to 2 degrees of warming. In order to meet this target, the IPCC has prescribed a global net carbon emissions. They need to be zero by 2050, basically. This would require a 45% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030. Even if this transition started today, it would be a really steep hill to climb. We'd need to be putting the pedal to the metal pretty quickly. But at the moment, we're actually moving in the opposite direction still. Global carbon emissions rose in 2017 and reached an all-time high in 2018. So I think on the surface, this issue of climate crisis does seem quite illogical. How could it be that we face such a crisis, it be so widely acknowledged, we know the cause of it, we have all of the technological solutions at our dispense, and yet, at the same time, the world continues on the same destructive path? I think the issue is that this question is not a scientific one now. It relates to the society in which we live, where such a seemingly illogical outcome is actually the systemic norm. I think to illustrate this, we should go back to Cyclone Idai and the situation in which it arose. So the same day that Cyclone Idai hit East Africa was the opening of the One Planet Summit, and this was headed up by former banker, French President Emmanuel Macron. So inside comfortable, acclimatized rooms, Macron encouraged global collaboration towards preservation of forests, and his mate, the President of Kenya, made a pledge, brave pledge, to achieve at least 10% forest cover in the next 3 to 5 years. Really quite pathetic commitments, and they would be laughable, I think, if they were not so tragic and this was not happening at the very same time. So at the same time as all these world elites were proclaiming their heartfelt commitment to saving the planet, new coal-fired power plants as well are being planned right now in South Africa, Senegal, the Congo, and Mozambique itself, really the centre of devastation of Cyclone Idai. Most of them are being co-financed by the African Development Bank, and on the board of that bank sit many of the members of African, European, American governments, some of whom were at this conference, the One Planet Conference. And I think as well, looking at this issue, a large part of the reason that so many people were so adversely affected by the cyclone is because of the extreme poverty that is faced by millions of people across this region. And it forces people to build homes that can't withstand storms, winds, etc. And poverty is not a natural condition of the people of Africa, but it's been built and maintained over many years. And today is ensured in countries like Zimbabwe through economic sanctions that are enforced by the European Union and the US, sanitation, emergency services, disease outbreak prevention. I didn't mention before, but recently there's been pandemic breakouts in these countries as well. All of these like public services are now pretty poorly resourced, and that's in no small part as well because of the neoliberal demands placed on these countries by the IMF and the World Bank. So I think you have to look to the broader system of capitalism in order to understand this problem. As a social, political, economic system, capitalism is both the reason why we stand on a burning planet, but it's also now the barrier to preventing change necessary to solve the environmental crisis. It's a deeply unequal, divided society in which the rich and powerful hoard all of the wealth and therefore hold the power. And this power is based upon the private ownership of the means of production, so factories, power plants, mines, etc. And the desire for capitalists to accumulate profits faster than their rivals is what drives a lot of this production and rapacious expansion as well. So I think we have to see that it's the actions of the ruling class, those with all of the power, who have created this crisis. Indeed, they actually take a lot of profit from it. And the people who attend these One Planet conventions and conferences and sign onto accords and such are not there because they genuinely care, but they're there to ensure that they continue to get away with it. But of course, I'm not just here to say that we are all doomed. By acknowledging, I think, the systemic causes of the climate crisis, the contours of a genuine solution to the situation we're facing can emerge. I think through organising collective power, it's possible to force some reforms from the system that are essential to avoiding the worst of the climate catastrophe. But ultimately, I think as well, by seeing how deeply capitalism is tied to environmental destruction, it becomes evident that only a socialist society, so an overturning of the society that we live in currently, is the only one that can solve the climate crisis. A genuinely democratic society and one that produces for use and not for profit. But is it really capitalism? It's not the dominant understanding of what has caused climate destruction for a really long time. So to varying degrees, I think, and in different words, most have blamed the climate crisis on humanity as a whole, or more specifically, poor people. The current geological age is being termed by some scientists as the Anthropocene, anthro from the Greek meaning human. This word, I think, reflects the idea that climate change is an issue of humanity as a whole, not a political question per se, and I think this is quite a classless analysis that sees humanity collectively being equally responsible for seas rising and bugs dying off and all this sort of thing. There's something intrinsic about human nature that leads to rapacious destruction. And in the mainstream and in the environment movement, I think the issue of environmental destruction for a really long time has focused on consumer choices and individual actions as really the primary causes of planetary destruction. So on the issue of climate change specifically and fossil fuels, the logic of supply and demand informs the general idea that the climate crisis is caused by too many people wanting fridges, too many people having light bulbs, etc. I think we have to start by saying that all of this is rubbish. The destruction of the planet is not an intrinsic feature of human existence, but is very specific to the current mode of production. The materials that under capitalism are burnt for energy have sat in the ground for actually a really long time. Coal is quite an ancient thing. And in their natural state underground, pose no threat to the planet or to human beings. For most of human history, people have lived collectively and produced for subsistence and not for profit. And these hunter-gatherer societies while severely limited in material wealth and technological capacity, existed in relative sustainable coexistence with the planet. So rather than being a condition of humanity for time immemorial, the extraction of coal and oil from the earth and the transformation of these materials into fuel went hand in hand with the Industrial Revolution and the emergence of capitalism, particularly in Britain in the 1800s. So in 1825, Britain accounted for 80% of global fossil fuel combustion, which is like a huge concentration. And this was because Britain held the advent of steam power. This was a very significant development in the means of production and required a shift in the way that production had been organised before. Andreas Malm writes in his book Fossil Capital that the power that was derived from fossil fuels was dual in meaning and in nature from the very beginning. So the coal-powered steam engine gave rise to an extremely powerful capitalist class. I think at every point since then as well, it's not just that it started in 1825 and like that's why we're here now. Since then, in the history of capitalism, the ruling class at every point has sought to prioritise its own short-term profits over the interests of humanity at literally every point in history, shaping the economy around their interests and how they want to run things. So, for example, solar power, which is often thought of like as a relatively recent innovation, has existed since the 1800s, but at the time that it came about, producing energy via coal was always quicker and cheaper than investing in this technology that was required to produce solar power. Similarly, selling millions of cars and designing cities around their use was much more profitable than improving and maintaining public transport systems that could get people around cheaper in the long term. Marx talked a bit about, Marx talked a lot about social relations becoming a fetter to the further development of society. And I think nothing really illustrates this point better than the incapacity of capitalist social relations to address the issue of fossil fuels. Worldwide, $13 trillion of capital are invested in infrastructure directly related to oil and gas production, refining and use. So like oil tankers, oil rigs, refineries, the pipelines, the gas stations, like millions and millions of dollars. And this doesn't even count as well all of the billions of dollars that are invested in roads, the manufacture of asphalt, rubber, cars and trucks and stuff. And the corporations and governments that have spent trillions of dollars investing in all of these things can't just write off all of the money that they've already spent in the economy. They have to use it to the fullest extent until their depreciation costs, I think, are acceptable. Talking about, I think, the climate crisis in this really systemic way is a really strong blow, I think, against those who argue that there's something intrinsically destructive about human beings, or that by throwing out your fridge or by driving an electric car, you can make a positive impact on the world. I think this is really an issue that is so infinitely beyond the capacity of an individual who has no control over how things are produced, and it's just so beyond our ability to impact as individuals. But what if all these capitalists, I guess, just decided on a moral basis, like, we don't want to pollute the planet anymore, like, it seems like a bad idea, it's pretty dirty and stuff. Is not climate change a convincing enough argument to these people to stop what they're doing? Unfortunately, moral arguments don't work on these people. Capitalist production is a really cutthroat competitive race. So if one fossil fuel company can't keep up with its rivals, they go bust. It's not enough to keep making the same amount of profits every year. They have to be always increasing profitability. So for fossil fuel companies, often that means finding new, potentially more destructive ways to increase output. And this competition as well, I think you can see it's what drives imperialism too. Because countries decide to control more and more resources. There is not an infinite amount of resources on the earth. So if capitalists want more, they have to start taking it from other people. And I think you only have to look to the modern history of the Middle East, a very oil-rich region of the world, to see what depraved lengths capitalists will go to for profit-making. I think as well, competition also means that the moral compulsion of the dying planet will not convince them to change their ways. Just because, like, another capitalist is always going to take it and jump in on their, like, turf, basically, they're just going to be knocked out of the market. Even in the advent of, like, there's a situation of green energy becoming profitable as well, fossil fuel companies have started to take up green energy too. So BP has some investments also in wind farms and solar plants and stuff in order to diversify, but not because they're trying to move away from their central source of power, which is oil. The profit motive and this ruthless competition also creates a totally anarchic mode of distribution, which I think really gets to the core as well of the climate crisis. Because things are not produced under capitalism, because our society gets together and democratically decides what needs making or how it's going to be made or in what quantity, etc. Instead, everything is produced simply to be sold on the market for a profit. So every individual capitalist firm gets, like, roughly estimates before they make it how much of a product they reckon they're going to be able to sell for the most return. And at the same time, they're constantly trying to outsell their competitors. So production is basically produced on a gamble. It's how the whole system functions. And inevitably, some capitalists win and some also lose. And very often this leads to enormous overproduction and waste. People may have seen the photographs of literally miles and miles of fields filled with cars that will never be used or sold or driven by anyone. And when you consider how much energy goes into making these vehicles and products, you know, altogether under capitalism, these cars are just going to sit and rust away. I think you really get a sense of how criminally inefficient this system is as well. You could think, perhaps in a sane society, if you had excess production for some reason too, all of these things would be distributed to people that need them. You know, there's a whole bunch of poor people who would really like a new car. Me, for instance, I don't have a car. That would be great. But unfortunately, that's not the way that things are allocated. Things that can't be sold for the price that is necessitated are often burnt rather than given to people who can't afford them, because that would undermine future profitability for the car firm that is selling them. And if that's not enough to make you angrier, just like the criminal levels of waste, I think, under capitalism, competition and desire for profit also pushes companies like Apple and Samsung, as well as many others, to deliberately produce consumer goods that won't last, to try and force you to buy more things. Old people often say to me that, things aren't built to last these days, and you kind of go, oh, whatever, but it's actually true. They really are not. What is often referred to as throwaway culture was deliberately created by corporations in the latter half of the 20th century in order to drive higher consumption patterns in order to force up profits. So huge amounts of waste is obviously the result. But as well, considering how much energy goes into these goods, how much energy goes into creating an iPhone or a car or anything like that, there's an enormous amount of fossil fuels that are invested in these materials that are burnt or thrown away. I think perhaps the most overwhelmingly and obvious injustice of capitalism is the extreme lack of democracy that we are granted, and the concentration of power in the hands of a few. So whilst the majority of people in Australia support radical action on climate change, our say over how our society runs is limited to voting once every 4 years for one of two parties who are wholeheartedly committed to serving the interests of coal companies. I mean, so obvious, Labor and Liberal in the Adani coal mine, and how it is that there's just no choice in the coming election. Every day it's the rich who are the ones who make decisions that keep our society on its currently environmentally destructive course. They are the ones who have the individual power to change things, but they choose not to. They are the ones who invest in new coal mines and fracking projects. They clear all the forest. They use chemicals that pollute the land and air and water, and they constantly profit from the overfishing of oceans too. Like, the list just goes on and on and on. Everything happens basically under capitalism because someone's profiting from it. So really, I think, to call the climate crisis as a whole a disaster gives far much cover, actually, to the ruling class, who have psychopathically, knowingly created this crisis. And even when confronted with, like, the most horrifying consequences of their actions, their resolve is not to change what they're doing in a, like, normal person kind of way, but to continue on that same destructive path. It's just unbelievable. And at the same time as creating these conditions, they also create the conditions of misery that afflict the majority of the world's population. Like, it's this entrenched poverty that people face all across the world that meant that they're the people who are going to suffer from the climate crisis ongoingly. So whether it's like 47 degree days in Western Sydney, pretty incredible, the hottest place in the world this summer, or the millions of premature deaths that are caused every year by pollution in Chinese cities, it's obvious the world over that it's the oppressed who will face the worst of the climate disaster. Okay, So by now, I hope you're convinced, at least somewhat, that capitalism is to blame for the climate crisis. So what does this mean for what we're going to do about it? I think all this means that if we are to win reforms from the system, it's not going to be like a walk in the park. It will be quite an enormous victory if we do win those things. Right now, I think it's pretty obvious that any proposal that might threaten the profits of the capitalists, whether it's more stringent environmental regulations or increased taxes to help fund sustainability measures, these are just rejected out of hand immediately, in spite of the general support that these measures may have amongst the population. George Monbiot writes in his book Heat a lot of really good stuff about how it is that we can force change on the planet. He says, governments will pursue this course of inaction, irrespective of the human impacts, while it remains politically less costly than the alternative. The task of climate change campaigners is to make it as politically expensive as possible. Writing, reading, debates, and dissent change nothing. They are only of value if they inspire action, and action means moving your legs. Real environmental reforms can and have been won under capitalism, but only under one condition, when people demand, organise, and fight for them. So the radicalisation of the 1960s, for instance, included a whole bunch of demands that the government must protect the land, air, and water from industrial pollution. In America, there was President Nixon, who is by no stretch of the imagination a greenie. Instead, he was a really paranoid, power-hungry conservative. But he felt compelled in this situation to create the Environmental Protection Agency that was to improve water and air quality, to lower vehicle emissions, and to stop dumping and polluting in the Great Lakes. So I think if we want to force meaningful change on the issue of the environment, we should look to these examples from the past and look to, as well, curtailing the power of corporations by forcing governments to regulate their operation. But kind of the problem is, like, when was the last time the government did anything against the interests of the rich? It's quite a remarkable situation we find ourselves in. When was the last time the government said, OK, we're going to nationalise this industry now and force some serious restrictions around this issue? In the last 30 years, governments across the world have had the opposite orientation, actually, privatising anything and everything. This is a neoliberal consensus of tax cuts for the rich, free markets, and trickle-down economics. And this is fundamentally at odds with all of the prescriptions of climate scientists, even the IPCC. And neoliberalism is a decades-long project of class warfare that the capitalist class are really desperate to hold on to. If governments started to shift from this consensus under pressure from a climate movement, or any other movement for that matter, they fear that people would want to apply the same logic of the reform that they had won to all other aspects of life. So if you've managed to say, like, well, this industry should be nationalised, why shouldn't all of them be? Why shouldn't healthcare, education and housing be a right? And I think this sort of consensus they've built up for a long time would lie in tatters, and their profits would be under serious threat. It would give so much confidence to movements everywhere. If we were able to win such reforms, I think people would start to gain a lot of confidence around a whole bunch of issues, like maybe we could have world equality. Like, maybe we could have a world without these people that run all the coal mines, etc. Indeed, Chris Bowen himself said, like, oh, well, we can't stop Adani, because maybe then the coal mine, you know, people might think we can stop every coal mine, and that would just be terrible, you know? So I think in this way you can see how change is necessary to save the planet would throw the basis for the immense privileges of the rich into serious doubt. So what you should learn from that, I think, is that a movement for climate justice must oppose the rich at every step. And in order to win, actually, we need a revolution that gets rid of this system and allows the capitalist class to flourish at the rest of the planet's expense. I think as well, we can't afford now to tinker around the edges or think that maybe we could fix a few things here or a few things there. In order to save the planet, really, we need to transform every single facet of industrial life. That's energy production, transportation, housing, trade, agriculture, manufacturing, waste production and treatment. All of these things require gigantic systemic change and complete structural reorganisation. So, like, agriculture, for instance, like, needs a total overhaul, reconstruction along sustainable lines, alongside a mass expansion of, like, alternative energy harnessing technologies. Like, these are all very expensive right now, but they need to be massively internationally coordinated social, political, economic projects. And I think if you're being realistic about the situation, the only way that we could achieve this vast restructure is in a society that didn't have profits and didn't have bosses and didn't have competition. So, for example, if you wanted to take carbon out of the atmosphere, which obviously we do, we need a global reforestation program that would require like a lot of international cooperation and a pooling of global resources. And this would be for a project as well that would diminish probably the profitability of large swathes of land that are currently owned by various capitalists and such. Rather than do this, I think the US would rather go to war for oil. You know, the idea that they could have international cooperation on this basis is pretty ludicrous. You know, we also need to totally reorganize food allocation, overhaul global transportation networks, and also just transform pretty much everything. Should clarify as well, when I say socialists, I don't mean like Sweden or Norway or any of these governments, particularly in the north of Europe, who have built their social democratic governments on the back, actually, of enormous oil money. More broadly as well, the process of like creating a socialist society has to be from below, I think. Even if you had politicians who were greener and nicer to us, this is not going to be enough to save the planet. Our capacity to change things in Parliament, even if it was you and me who are running for presidency, would be drastically limited, I think, by the power of the ruling class, those who control production. So politicians, even self-proclaimed socialist ones, I think have very limited power to challenge the core of the system. So my phone is buzzing. Take Ocasio-Cortez, for instance, who's very popular at the moment. A self-described socialist, author of the Green New Deal, I think this is a really excellent policy. If it was implemented, it would be a huge step forward, really, in the fight against climate change. And it's wonderful that just transitions and massive government intervention into the economy is the politics of the moment right now and how it is that people think you need to solve the climate crisis. But I think it's not enough to have good ideas and write them in bills. If you want to come up against today's neoliberal world, you have to have power. If you want to go up against the US ruling class and their vested interest in the oil industry, you have to have power. And this power cannot be gained through the votes, through the Democratic Party, who are very much tied, I think, to the system as it stands. I think, really, the Green New Deal and its prescriptions could only be won in the context of a pre-revolutionary situation, when the capitalists really feel like they would have to grant us something out of fear for what would happen otherwise. As well, of course, when I'm talking about socialism, I don't mean the horrendous dictatorships of the USSR or China, both of which are responsible as well for enormous crimes against the planet. So we need this society that produces for use and not for profit. This is a classless society, one that is genuinely democratic, so no more rulers or governments or billionaires or anyone who has a structural interest in putting profit before the planet and the people. And you can't predict or blueprint exactly the ways in which this socialist society would run. But I think the possibilities are pretty unlimited when you imagine a world in which billions of human minds as well would be free to participate in the building of a new society that no longer requires like extreme oppression and subordination in order to function. Okay, so in order to abolish the profit motive and achieve actual democracy, which would be, I think, prerequisites of a sustainable planet, there has to be a transformation of society at the point of production. So instead of a small minority owning the shops and the coal mines and the factories, the people that make everything should run anything, everything. It is here, I think, in the workplace where there is a latent potential power to stop the flow of profits and produce according to need instead of for profit. And in this society of direct democracy, decisions about how to save the planet and how to shift to renewable energy would be common sense. Actually, it wouldn't be such a complicated process. And with today's technology, it could be done really rapidly. There are so many examples, I think, that you could take from the history of the ingenuity of ordinary people in struggle to kind of point to as a way that we could solve the climate crisis. But one that I really liked reading about recently was the Greek factory workers at a plant called Viome in 2011. These were workers that spent their time manufacturing toxic chemicals for the construction industry. So at the height of the economic crisis, these staff clocked into work to find that the owners of their chemical company had gone bust and abandoned the site totally. And this was in the midst of an enormous economic depression. And from here, like, the common logic is they're doomed. These workers are going to be thrown on the scrap heap, there's going to be immediate layoffs, and all of these families will be plunged into poverty. Instead, the workers at Viome decided that they weren't going to put up with that, and they occupied their own plant and they turned it upside down. The workers took over their plant with the help of their neighbours as well, and immediately they asked, you know, their neighbours to just help them out, like, what do you want to be done, guys? And the number one demand of their neighbours was, please stop making these chemicals that are running into the water systems and making us and our children sick. So instead of making more chemicals, the workers at Viome, once they'd taken over their plant, they started making instead olive oil soaps and gentle detergents for people to clean their homes. So no more strong industrial chemicals that were burning the eyes and throats of the workers too and caused significant damage to the environment. It's a really lovely story. One Guardian columnist wrote of the plant that this is a story of a bunch of middle-aged men and women who spend their entire lives on the wrong end of barked orders about what to do and when to do it, who then seize ownership of their own workplace and their own lives. And when they did this, they immediately aligned themselves to the highest principles of equality, sustainability, and justice. And one participant, a guy called Demetrius, was interviewed during the occupation, and he said, "Before, I was doing only one thing and had no idea what the others were doing. And now, we're all united. We have forgotten the concept of I and can function collectively as we." Obviously, this example is not socialism. Far from it. The workers at Viome were isolated. They had no capacity by themselves to challenge the structures that uphold the capitalist system. But imagine if this experiment were to be generalised across a whole country or a whole society. Socialism is about expanding the experience of people in the Viome plant to the whole country through the united mass struggle of workers for democratic control of the society in which we ourselves create. And this may sound unrealistic or idealistic, but actually we've seen it many times before. So in revolutions throughout history, embryonic institutions of mass working class power have emerged as a challenge to the minority rule of the capitalist class that creates all of the crisis and destruction. And these have been called different things in different places, so Soviets in Russia, cordones in Chile, and shoras in Iran. They're called different things wherever. But they're workers' councils, in past revolutionary struggles, have organised millions of workers and members of the community as well, and have extended out from workplaces to national and regional areas in order to organise society based on working class power. And in these hubs, bosses, state bureaucrats, politicians, all of these people, criminals who have kept society on its destructive path for so long, have been replaced by instantly recallable delegates. And I think by looking to these experiments in radical democracy, you can see the capacity for a system of democratic planning that could organise and guide a rapid transformation of the economy in the interests of ordinary people, you know, the majority of people and the planet. Okay, I think I've probably got to wrap up. To conclude, I think we should say that another world is not only possible, but it is totally necessary if we are to stave off total collapse of the planet. If we do not now throw everything that we have into the struggle for climate justice, eventually, there will be no world left to win. But in order to win the reforms that are necessary to hold off this disaster, we cannot beg at the feet of the rich and powerful. As Greta Thunberg, the leader of the school strike movement, has argued, we have to make the ruling classes panic. We have to build a movement that is so enormous that they can no longer ignore us. But even winning these reforms through a mass movement, social movements, would not be enough. In order to achieve a truly sustainable society for generations to come, there is no option but to overthrow capitalism and to build a socialist society from the bottom up.